So when I started thinking this week about what I might talk about today, I found myself actually much more interested in knowing what's on your minds than what's on my mind. And so I thought actually it'd be nice today, rather than me giving a talk, is for you to ask some questions. And my comments might be relevant to those of you here rather than me guessing what might be relevant. And that's what I had in mind today. So if anybody has any questions, we can take a few moments, see if you have any good ones. They say all questions are good. Jim, if you can pass the mic there, behind you.
One thing that I've been thinking a lot about in terms of meditation is how language becomes a barrier. It feels like a barrier to me. From getting to the essence of things. I was thinking about how children, before they learn language, must experience the world just as it is. They see a tree and it's green, and you know, they just experience it for what it is. Whereas I see the tree, and I see the word tree in my head. I hear the word tree, and how I feel like I have this yearning in my meditation practice to get past the words. And I feel like I'm not sure I'm striving for something that is sort of not possible anymore, you know, because I have language, or if it's something that I can get to at some point. And I was just wondering, you know, if anybody else has any ideas about that, or how you feel about that, Gil. Can you get past the language?
Great question. Thank you. It's a big topic. And you asked about language, and language is a little bit an abstract concept, so we might have to get a little bit more specific to be able to address the issues. Our capacity to use words and labels and verbal descriptions of things is both a blessing and a curse. So it's important to see it both ways, and not one or the other way. In Zen, sometimes they talk about words that kill and words that bring life. So, and if you read the autobiography of Helen Keller, she gives a beautiful description of discovering words for the first time, and her life just suddenly blossomed, opened up. In a way that hadn't been possible until she had words. So there is a kind of beauty in a kind of unmediated contact with the world, but it's also a relatively limited world we live in. And human beings have a very rich and multidimensional life, very much because of our capacity to have words and language and all that. It really enriches our life tremendously. But at the same time, words can get in the way. And it isn't so much that words get in the way, maybe more how we relate to the words, how we see the words. So in Buddhism, there's generally not some idea of trying to get back to some childlike, innocent, pure perception free of words. But rather, there can be things that approach that, but not completely. You can't completely get there. It's not like the Holy Grail of Buddhism, to find this place where there's no words and just you and the tree, and you know. But one of the things that's possible to do, it's possible to quiet down the discursive thinking. And a lot of the problems is when we live in the words. We live in the discursive words. And so we're telling ourselves stories, describing things, we're exploring, we're questioning, trying to figure things out, all in that inner kind of verbal landscape of thinking to ourselves. And it's very clear to me that sometimes it's kind of like a maze, the inner discursive world. and we're trying to figure out something, understand, and it's kind of mazy. There's no out. And so you have to find some way to kind of step outside the maze. You're not going to find your way out by thinking your way out. And so thinking our way out of a lot of life problems is often not that helpful. Though, so meditation is one way of learning to step outside of living in our discursive mind. If that makes sense to have the language. So our discursive mind, our thinking mind, is a very important capacity we have. But, you know, it's perhaps, you know, it's overrated. You know, it certainly overrates itself. And so, you know, it's important, you know, it's very important, but maybe it's, you know, 10% of what it is to be a human being. But when people live only in their discursive thinking, then, you know, you can live in a kind of truncated life. Sometimes they go along with the way in which, you know, you don't see the tree. Reminds me of when I was in the monastery in Japan. There was a Japanese monk there who I asked him, he'd been there for a number of years, and I asked him what brought him to be a Zen monk. And he said he'd been living on a farm for many years, a commune in Japan, and kind of in a rural, deep in the mountains, somewhat isolated. And he said, after living at this farm for 7 years, one day he looked up and he realized that for the first time he realized that the trees were green. You know, of course he knew the trees were green, but somehow he hadn't really seen it in some very clear way. And he wanted to kind of be able to live that way, so he went and joined the Zen monastery. But rather than being tricked, rather than stopping to think, one of the possibilities here is we see words for what they are. We see the word tree is not the tree, but it's quite a wonderful phenomenon that the mind produces this concept, this word and concept bubbles up and is connected to the history of all the other trees we've seen, and it's connected to maybe some wonderful experience of sitting under the shade of a tree when we're, you know, 13 years old, and it's all this rich world that's possible. But that world of words connected to the word tree, associations, is not the tree. And one of the things we start doing with Vipassana meditation is we start seeing concepts and words for what they are, not for what they're pointing at. Does that make sense? So one of the things that I find helpful is, in this regard, is I find it very helpful not to think that the discursive world, the inner landscape of thinking and words, is where my life primarily resides, or where the solutions of my life are going to be found. But I don't disrespect that part of my life, the thinking and all that. I think it's an important part of the puzzle of the big piece of who a human being is. But if I have something really important I want to figure out or understand about my life, I find it really helpful to do something like meditate, and or to go for a long walk or something. Something that actually stops my preoccupation with the world of thoughts, and allows some other deeper or more complete process of consideration, of exploration, of intuition to operate. So for me, it's the fact that I have confidence in a inner world that is different than the inner landscape of discursive thought, the inner place of discursive thought. I'm not so caught by those discursive thinking. And, you know, sometimes I am, but I know there's another place. I know there's a better place, another place to be. So then I'm willing to kind of switch my attention from one place to the other. How do we get out of our thinking or out of our words so we can see something more directly? One of the first steps to that is to learn to relax. You know, the more relaxed, the more tranquil, the more calm the mind can be, the more easy it is to see clearly what's there. And it's when your mind is calm enough, you can actually see the tree, and you see in relation to that tree, you see the word rising in the mind, tree, or good tree, or bad tree, or you know, all these judgments or ideas we might have. And you see it arising, and you see it in arising, in that concept arising in the mind, you see that it's different from what you're looking at. And then you see there's a difference between those two. And then you have a choice by where you put your attention, because you see that difference. And so you can put your attention then at the seeing of the tree, instead of your attention at the judgments, the ideas, or the words around tree. And I think this is a very important aspect, a very important helpful thing in mindfulness practice, is when we can see that difference. And so that between words, concepts, and what actually is. And so then we can't stop the words, but we can shift our attention to be able to see and feel and all that. Does that make sense at all, Hillary? Does it really? All these words. Yes, Hilda.
Thank you. To build on what Hilary just was asking you about, do you have anything more to say about anxiety?
Anxiety? Anything more to say about anxiety?
Well, it seems it's very similar to what she's talking about, but what I notice is that anxiety has been key to me in the last year or so, and it gets in the way of healing as well.
Yeah.
So I wonder what more you'd say about that.
That's perceptive. So anxiety gets in the way of healing. So, you know, last fall here at IMC, I arranged for two people to come and teach a series of called Mindfulness-Based Management of Depression, because it was my sense that there's an epidemic, it's a contagious phenomena of depression in our society. Who did I catch it from? So I mentioned that to someone, and someone else came up to me and said, yeah, it's true, but actually much more pervasive in our culture is, this is someone who's supposed to know, like a psychologist, I think, told me, much more pervasive than depression is anxiety. Anxiety is really big, and we should do a mindfulness-based class for anxiety. So certainly recognize how important it is, fear, anxiety, worry, the whole range of things, and you know, relaxing is so important. Being calm and relaxed, when the mind and body is relaxed, that's you tend generally for certain kinds of healing, it tends to optimize the possibility of healing, and so anxiety is there, it kind of interferes with that. Or was it last week or a couple of weeks ago? I talked about this oxytocin thing, and so oxytocin is this chemical that gets released when people are compassionate, but it also released when women give birth, and one of the chemicals in the blood system that inhibits oxytocin is adrenaline. And so the idea, the kind of evolutionary idea, is that when a woman was out there in the savannas of Africa giving birth, and the lion came along around, then she would get scared and produce adrenaline, and the adrenaline would inhibit the oxytocin, which would inhibit the birth, and so she could run away. Very nice. And then later, when she got, you know, safe some other place, then, you know, the adrenaline relaxed and oxytocin could go and labor could start again. So anxiety, you know, anxiety produces these chemicals which are really bad for us, you know, not very, especially when they're chronic. So your quick question is, how do we deal with that? How do we work with it? And, you know, there's a variety of answers to that question. And, I mean, I think a wise life that incorporates mindfulness realizes that mindfulness is one, is the kind of like the, there's one tool among many. Mindfulness is one, it's kind of like, mindfulness is kind of like the captain of a ship with a big crew. And so the captain kind of keeps track of everything, knows what's going on in the boat, knows about the wind and the sea conditions and everything about the boat and all the people, but then knows which of the different sailors to call upon if different things are needed, which sails to take up, who throws the anchor, who starts the engine, all kinds of things. So mindfulness is important then to help us to not to have one answer to anxiety, but to be able to look at the ship of our life and then see, you know, in our particular situation, what is it that's most needed. And different people need different things. For some people in our culture, one of the solutions to anxiety is not to work so much. Some people are really driven, and they're over fatigued, overtired by working, always pushing, and it builds up the stress, stress in our system that produces anxiety, and then it's kind of chronic. And it's not necessarily a psychological so much cause, but rather almost like a structural cause because of the way kind of going all the time. So you have to look at their behavior. What kind of behavior can we change so that the anxiety isn't there so much? Behavioral changes are sometimes necessary. Sometimes anxiety has to do with issues of ego, of our self-identity. And so sometimes you have to look very honestly at what is this way, what is the belief we have about who we think we are, who we need to be, how we need to represent ourselves to other people. And is it realistic? Is it accurate? Or is it possible to relax some of the ways in which we're uptight socially about how people see us and how? And some anxiety has a lot to do with wanting people to see us in a particular way or wanting certain things from other people. And so so we're anxious to get it and want it. Anxiety sometimes can be based on unrealistic goals and unrealistic desires. And so sometimes it's helpful to question the desires we have or the goals we have for our lives. And, the idea that, you're only going to be successful and happy in life if you have a certain level of wealth. And so you're chasing after wealth, anxious to have the wealth because that's the solution to being happy. And that's, I think most people who find themselves happy don't find that this. Most people find themselves happy don't find it dependent on being wealthy. Or a lot of people who've gotten wealthy haven't discovered more happiness because of it. And so these are all kind of stepping back and considering the situation, looking at what's going on here with the anxiety. Sometimes anxiety is deeply embedded in people's psyche for a variety of reasons. So sometimes the deep psychic levels get triggered or pop up. And so it's almost like there's different levels of the mind, and different points, different levels get activated. And you can go through years and years of a life without getting certain levels activated. And then something happens that activates some of them. Some of it has to do with childhood experiences. As children or as young adults or something, something happens that teaches people or is kind of giving people the sense that the world can't be trusted and other people can't be trusted. And so there's some kind of deep kind of wound or deep unresolved or undeveloped aspects in the heart about that's really mistrustful of people and mistrustful of life and feel like we'll never get enough, we'll never be taken care of, there's never enough in it for us, there's never enough love, there's never enough food, there's never enough something. And so that anxiety is kind of chronic. I see it in the people who survived wars. I've known a lot of people who went through wars as children. And there's a level of anxiety that's always there because this childhood experience of being traumatized by the bombs exploding. And then there's other psychic aspects of our life which are more universal. There are people who are anxious around death and dying, right? And so there's some very deep issues wanting to survive or wanting to exist. And then it can be helpful to be able to look at that, what's going on there. And I know some people have found a lot of benefit by actually looking, seeing what is it they're actually afraid of around dying. And to actually pinpoint it rather than keeping it abstract. Because some people are afraid to, when they're confronted of death, they're not necessarily afraid of not existing or being dead, but they're afraid of suffering while they die. Or they're afraid of the suffering that's going to be left in the people's lives who they leave behind. Or, you know, there's anxiety has, you know, to actually name and recognize what the particular anxiety is around dying can now sometimes be helpful. And so this is all kind of, this whole track I'm taking now and talking about anxiety is emphasizing the value of stepping back and really studying it, looking at it, and trying to understand it. And so then with Hillary's question about language and thoughts, tying those two issues together, if anxiety is the glue that keeps us glued to our discursive thoughts, discursive world, so we can't get out of kind of thinking anxiously about something and trying to fix it, you know, with our anxious thoughts, and we keep stuck in those loop, then sometimes it's helpful to go and talk to someone else about your anxiety, like a therapist or a good friend or someone, who, because then sometimes having another person involved in the system can help you kind of break the mold or break the pattern of being stuck inside the anxious thought patterns. And so it helps you kind of step outside and begin to try to understand it, the bigger picture. What's going on here? What is my anxiety like? And try to kind of tease it apart, understand it in some way. So that's all a lot about understanding it, trying to understand it. And then the other aspect is what to do about it. And once you have some understanding of it. And so there's, you know, again, there's a variety of things you might do. And sometimes a boat is in a storm, you pull down the sails and just wait the storm out. So I think sometimes with some anxiety, maybe it's better just to kind of wait it out. And in the last year, I've had this strange thing where, twice now, where I felt some hybrid of being feeling very vulnerable and a little bit anxious. And I thought, this is odd. What's this about? It's not so common in my life these days. And so I thought, what's going on? Because it happened early once, the second time I was a little bit wiser about it. But maybe it happens again, I'll be wiser even still. And what it seems to correlate to is getting a cold. And it's like the first symptom of getting a cold. And so the first time I had it, I thought, oh my God, you know. You know, it was a big deal. I thought, oh, I have to fix it. And now maybe it's just, you know, an early warning sign that I'm getting a cold. And just, you know, there's not much to do about it except, you know, lower the sails and sit it out. Maybe. I think that mindfulness meditation can be, any kind of meditation practice is a great help for anxiety. And there's different kinds of meditation you can do. Some people find great benefit from doing concentration meditation when they're anxious. Just focusing on something like the breath and counting the breath. Sometimes doing loving kindness meditation, which is concentration practice. Anything that gets you concentrated, that gets you out of its orbit. So you're not preoccupied and caught by it. It can be very helpful. Concentration meditation is also very helpful because it's relaxing. And the more you relax, the less you can be anxious. And relaxation is a wonderful antidote. So some people actually do relaxation practices, you know, progressive relaxation through the body to deal with their anxiety. some people like to do mindfulness meditation when they're anxious. And I've known people who reported, you know, great delight and great benefit from doing mindfulness when they feel terror or anxious in some way. And sometimes they say it's like being at the rodeo, if the fear is strong enough. You sit down, close their eyes, pay attention, and it's just wild in there. And, you know, all this energy and feelings are bouncing, going this way and that way, and it's just like... And often the tendency is all these feelings and emotions and thoughts is we get hooked by them, we get caught by them, or we get anxious about them, or we believe them or something. But in mindfulness meditation, we're not trying to believe anything. We're not trying to be hooked by anything. We're not trying to react to anything. We're just making space in our body and our minds for those feelings to kind of course through us. And so if you kind of give that kind of freedom to those feelings to be there, it can be like the rodeo. You know, it's like, wow, you know, sometimes it's hard to sit still even. And that's, you know, sometimes the sign of a good meditation session is very much dependent on what's going on in your life. So, you know, there's no one standard for what a good meditation is supposed to be like, right? So it's all depends on what you're given, right? What you're being offered. And if what you're offered is a lot of anxiety, a really successful meditation session might be that you didn't leave your cushion before the end of the sitting. That's it, isn't it? You know, you didn't fall off the horse. So then sitting in mindfulness, you know, and then feeling the anxiety in your body. I think that's one of the most very important things to do. And there are people who actually sit down and feel the tremendous sensations of fear and anxiety in the body. And sometimes it can be very hard, if the anxiety is strong, to stay there, because it's kind of like touching a hot frying pan. Just recoil from it, or it produces more anxiety. But to learn the skills and the capacity to feel fear in your body physically, and then let the body be the container of it. Let the body kind of hold it, as opposed to trying to hold it or react to it or deal with it with our thinking. My guess is that the fair percentage of the time that people have trouble with fear, anxiety, or tear, or panic, it has to do with they're still in their thoughts around it, thinking about it. If they can get out of our thoughts about it, not think about it so much, but let the attention go, let our primary attention go away from thinking and into the physical body, and let the body feel the sensations of fear and anxiety, then and then trust that, stay there, then usually the body will calm down with time. It'll slowly calm down and calm down. And I've met a lot of people coming here to IMC who have been dealing with anxiety and found that feeling it in their body just really made a huge difference. There was one man, I remember some years ago, who came here, and he said that he'd been meditating. He started meditating for about a year, and he had a lot of anxiety. And at some point, his children came up to me and said, "Dad, are you okay? Do you need to go see a doctor or something?" And he said, "No, I'm completely fine." And he said, "Well, you're not anxious." They come to expect him to always be anxious, and they know something strange when he wasn't. And then it's possible to turn the question kind of around. Sometimes it's useful to do, and not ask about anxiety, but ask about the opposite. So before I tell you what I thought the opposite is today, what are some of you think the opposite of anxiety is? Calm? Hail, that's calm. Some other opposites? Complacency? Complacency? Okay.
Acceptance.
Equanimity, acceptance.
Peacefulness.
Feeling
a joyous uplift.
Joyous uplift.
Having a variety of different thinking patterns.
Having a variety of thinking patterns in your mind.
Equally important.
So be more fluid in your thinking. You kind of go back and forth between different things. Sometimes you're anxious, sometimes you're filled with desire, sometimes lust, sometimes... But yeah, I think the fluidity in mind is a great thing. And that's, in some sense, that's one of the things we're trying to look for in meditation, is not a particular experience. Many people are looking for experience. And this is going to do it for me. And I think a mature practitioner is someone who has the fluidity to be able to actually move freely, not be stuck in any particular place. Yes?
The opposite of anxiety is sloth and torpor.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
There is some wisdom to that, because the in the classic list of the hindrances, restlessness and anxiety is paired with sloth and torpor, and one is being hyper-energized and one is being kind of So there is a kind of truth to that. But what I'm looking for here is the healthy opposite. Yes, George.
Contentment.
Contentment. Right.
Spaciousness.
I feel like it's got to be have two components, because anxiety is both you're predicting an outcome and then you're afraid of the outcome. So you have to let go of the prediction, the knowing of the outcome, and then fear of the outcome. So there's, I guess I think of it as trust.
Mm-hmm. Trust. Right? Mm-hmm. So trust in what?
Well, trust that A, even if it does happen, you'll be okay, and B, that it might not happen.
So what if you're afraid of, what if you're anxious about what if you're anxious about dying?
Well, that's where you have the A, it'll be okay.
The interesting thing about deep meditation practice, for those people who've had the opportunity to do go on long retreats and go to deep practice, is that at least for some people, I don't know if everyone characterizes it this way, but it is a kind of it's a preparation for dying. And I think the kind of trust or the kind of ease or the kind of letting go that can happen in deep meditation is very much akin to probably happens as people die, kind of deep letting go, or can happen if the dying happens slow enough. And it's been said that the people who do a lot of meditation tend to have a lot less fear around dying than people tend not to have much experience in meditation. The only people who apparently who have more, this is one study I read many years ago, the one category of people who tend to have even less fear around dying than people who meditate a lot, or was people who took a lot of psychedelics. this is not a plug for psychedelics. Someone else?
I have a question.
Oops. Oh. Yeah.
Oh, I think that trust in something that's not a thought.
So trusting in something which is not a thought. Yes.
Whatever the mind can help me name it.
Trust your body. So for you, thoughts are anxiety related. So we can think ourselves, I mean, I've seen people, I've been myself, you know, sit around, you know, just happy, can be content, wonderful things, everything's wonderful. And then you're minding your own business and some thought happens. and suddenly the stomach clenches and, you know, you get a headache and, you know, just because this one thought arose, you know, leave me alone. And so thinking, yeah. Yes?
I think of, anxiousness as being something, a fear about the future, so the lack of it, the opposite would be some combination of acceptance. So you could be dying. And so that's a known fact now, so you can either anxious about the thing coming towards you.
Yeah.
And acceptance of it would be being more with that. And then an openness up to curiosity about it, an interest in, maybe even a quality of playfulness.
Yes. The other thing I wanted to say is that loving kindness is actually a tremendous antidote for anxiety and fear. To practice loving kindness, and loving kindness loving kindness, love, both of those we can do for ourselves, but also what we can receive for others at times can be very helpful. Sometimes as people are dying, it can be very helpful to have people around who are loving. It's kind of, you know, just that is almost enough sometimes. Yeah.
I found that in practicing about anxiety is to practice on little things and to do that a lot. And then you have a lot of tools to bring to bear when you have some big anxiety.
Beautiful. Do you hear that? Probably not. So he said that he finds it very helpful to practice on the small anxieties. And so then you have some tools when there's big anxieties. And I think that's really wise. Because I think sometimes it's easy to let the small anxieties go. You don't pay attention to them. You can get by just fine without them. and without paying attention to them, I mean. And so they're kind of there, kind of around, but actually if you begin kind of lifting weights with the 1 pound weights, then, you know, when you get to the 50 pound weights, you can really do it.
Going beyond yourself with the emotion and thinking about everyone in the world experiencing what you're experiencing, and breathing in the difficulty of what you're feeling and breathing out the clearer, calmer feeling. And just going beyond yourself, when you mentioned about like kind of made me think of that, but if you can ever get beyond yourself, you seem to get to a clearer place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The feeling.
Yes. No, Pat's been trying.
It's interesting because I was been trying to remember a sutta that has to do with death, and it's one where there's a woman who the Buddha either instructs to meditate on death for a year, and then when she comes back and reports on it, her answers are all something like don't know or can't know or whatever, and all the monks are annoyed, but the Buddha then explains that these are very wise answers. Do you remember that sutta at all?
Yeah. There's a young woman who, I don't remember it right now exactly, but yeah, Buddha asks something like, where are you from? And she said, I don't know. And don't you know? Buddha says, and she says, I do know. So everything he says, she kind of does the opposite. People think she's really disrespectful, but it's kind of like a little quiz, and she answers right.
But didn't it all have to do with death in some way?
Yeah. So, anxiety certainly and fear should have our great respect, and I think it's very much multidimensional, and it's also important not to be too caught up in its orbit. I mean, it's also possible to get too involved with trying to fix it and solve it, and as if it's really that important. It is important, it can be very important for some people. There's also what Buddhism keeps pointing to in its depth is that there is another dimension of life, which is a dimension of peace, which is independent from the world of conditions. So anxiety belongs to the world of conditions, and you can kind of try to fix the conditions of the world so they're just right for you, or you can realize that there's also this other dimension of peace, and if you have a sense of that other dimension of peace, it gives you a different vantage point for understanding the conditioned world. So it's come somewhat akin to if you're out in the ocean in a big storm, and you're kind of floating there, you're a swimmer and you're swimming in a big storm, and the waves are breaking and the winds, and it's kind of frightening. But then if you dive underneath the water, you don't have to go very far, and maybe sometimes 5-6 feet is all you need to go, and you can look up, and you see up there on the surface of the water, you see that it's kind of choppy up there, but down 5-6 feet below, it's actually quite peaceful, and so you're not denying the surface, but you're seeing the surface from this place of peace. And so what Buddhism is, as always I'm trying to point to, is a dimension of peace, or dimension of that dimension of life which is not part of the conditioned realm of experience. And so we don't always get caught trying to fix the conditions. That's what I'd like to say. It's kind of a cliche. If you're only trying to fix the conditions, it's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. So you have to kind of also realize some other dimension. So that's why sometimes one of the ways of working with anxiety and fear is not working on it directly, but rather, for example, doing some really deep spiritual work, like going on a long retreat and really sitting still and really going deep, so you can touch some different level, a different dimension of your life, and realize there's much more to who you are, much more to life than what you thought there was. And if you realize there's more, then you might have less occasion to be anxious. If you think the only thing that's important in life is your job, then you can have a lot of anxiety about your job. But if you realize that that's only one dimension of life, there's many other dimensions which are maybe even more important, then there might not be as much anxiety around the job or whatever. Make sense? So, thank you. I appreciated hearing your questions and concerns and comments. And it's great for me. And thank you.